This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
There are two rules to remember if you want to have a good time.
Rules! No rules!
Rule number one.
Keep your friends close, but your enemies closer.
Rule number two.
You're a dragon. Be a dragon.
This week on Double Dragon, Steve does his first viewing of the almost universally despised episode of Season 8, The Bells. This is Episode 5. This is the episode where Danny snaps and burns all of King's Landing to ashes. This episode has massive problems, but of course, Steve and I also talk about the things that we enjoyed in this episode as well. Okay, before we get to Steve, you'll remember that one of the key features of Double Dragon is that every now and again I will bring on a medievalist to get a little bit of insight into the medieval literature and history that inspired House of the Dragon. So this week, I will include a short excerpt of my conversation with medieval historian Ian McGuinness. Ian is a professor of history at the University of the Highlands in Scotland. In this conversation, I ask Ian a little bit about the construction of King's Landing relative to historical castles that we meet in medieval Europe. If you have a question for Double Dragon, you can email that to book@baldmove.com. And of course, we always appreciate ratings and reviews on iTunes. And now your friend and mine, comic Steve Osborne. Steve, we got some Apple iTunes feedback for Double Dragon. And we encourage this. We like this. This helps us. So I thought I would read a couple reviews.
And we're Double Dragon's barely a thing, right?
So here's the thing with this is that I think a lot of the reviews on this feed are for our previously Perfect Stranger Things feed, because we used that feed to launch Double Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a review that you would like to leave specifically about this podcast, that would be helpful.
Yeah, Double Dragon.
Double Dragon. Or if you just have a review that you'd like to leave for any podcast.
Ours or otherwise.
Yeah. Use, you know, David Axelrod's The Axe Files.
I'd love to hear what our listeners think of
it. Write it on ours. Don't write it on his. He doesn't need fine. It. He's fine. He does not need it. You got a review for Stuff You Should Know? Go ahead and write it on our feed.
I would like it if our podcast and podcast review section was kind of like the What's Playing channel at in a hotel TV.
Sure.
This is what you could be doing. This is what else you could be doing.
All right. This is love this show. Looking forward to coverage of House of the Dragon. I think the hosts have great chemistry, and I'm already a fan of their other podcasts. I just thought this would be a good time to mention that we do have other podcasts, Steve. So if people are interested in our crocheting podcast, we've got
yeah, that's right. It's called Spinning a Yarn.
We crochet and lie at the same time. We just
yes,
outlandishly.
Yeah, it's like three lies and a lie. It's very entertaining. The biggest lie being that we're crocheting.
Cocoons of Horror, it's where we review movies. Not all horror, you know. You'd think that it was specifically about horror, but as we've talked a lot, not a very well-named podcast.
We don't talk about cocoons either. We don't know a lot about Metamorphosis.
And then, of course, you might know us from Perfect Stranger Things, which you can find on the Dungeons and Demogorgons feed at Bald Moon.
How does that work?
It doesn't. It doesn't really work.
Because I'm going, I wonder what people think of us. And then I'll look on there and I'm like, I don't know who they're talking about when it comes to reviews. So I'm wondering if people know that we're different people.
I'm not sure that I am a different person.
Because I know you have, like, you prefaced the episode with, it says Perfect Stranger Things on it.
Yeah.
But, like, if you were just to pick that up, it would it be confusing if you were to, I don't.
Everything we do is confusing, Steve. That's kind of our brand. We are.
The Cocoons of Horror thing being that, hey, we're going to talk about The Last Duel.
Yeah. Yeah, Cocoons of Horror is not necessarily about horror, and people cannot say horror or spell cocoons. Spell cocoon.
Yeah, so we're really, we created the least searchable and the least pronounceable podcast at the same time.
Uh-huh. Double Dragon started as a Stranger Things podcast, so that's confusing. And then Perfect Stranger Things is now on the Dungeons and Demogorgons feed, which at least you kind of have, you know, it's the same show that's being covered. But you know, it's different people, and it's hard to tell.
Different people, yeah.
Hard to tell who the people are. Which one are you, Steve? Just to let people know, which one are you?
I'm Aaron.
Okay, good. Very good. I'm Jim Hopper. This one's called Sleep Cocoon. I put my earbuds in at night and listen, dozing off, to a world of streaming nonsense. Thank you. This is written by Slappy Conqueso. I think this guy, he gets it. He gets it.
Yeah, well, he certainly, yeah. Yeah, no, I think he does. I think he understands what we're here for. And we're here to put you to sleep. We're like a white noise machine, though Anthony might be a little bit more of like an olive skin noise machine.
First off, Sleep Cocoon. I like that he knows how to spell cocoon. But I do want to talk about, you know, whether or not you and I are entertaining enough to keep anyone awake. I think the answer is no.
Better a sleep aid than a, an alarm clock, I guess.
Do you ever listen to anything while you sleep, or is silence preferred?
I usually go to the sleep of my own tinnitus.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so it's just ringing in your ears as you sleep.
Yeah, it's more of like a hiss and a murmur.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And please join us on our other podcast called Hiss and Murmur,
where we discuss all of the parcel tongue characters in the Harry Potter universe.
Well, actually, it's just where Anthony hisses and I murmur over it.
All right, that is all the feedback for this week. If you have a review you'd like to leave for any podcast anywhere, do it over at Double Dragon. We would love to hear a review almost for any podcast. That would be great. And now a conversation with Professor Ian McInnes. So I'm with Ian McInnes, and Ian, you're a real life medieval historian. Is that right?
I am, yes. I study mostly the 14th century and medieval Scotland, but I also interested in particularly in the military history of the Middle Ages more generally.
And what led you to that terrible life decision?
Oh, to study medieval history.
Yeah. And,
so it's a good. Well, yeah, that takes me right back to my undergraduate degree. I mean, mm-hmm. I started with a dissertation topic, I think, there, and then kind of built it from there through my master's and beyond. But I suppose it was an attractive period, but also one I thought that was still quite understudied. So it was, uh-huh. It was one that I could see myself carving out a niche in.
Okay, now you're interested in Scottish history and specifically warfare. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so my thesis was on war and chivalry during the period of the Scottish Wars of Independence. So I'm kind of most interested in conduct in war and how that's exhibited and perhaps how that affects the way that war is fought.
Uh-huh. Now you tell me if this is relates to your story at all, but my feeling is that most folks who are interested in medieval studies got into it because of some kind of fantasy narrative, or they saw Braveheart, or there was something that kind of piqued their imagination. And I'm wondering, did you have sort of a less than realistic entry point into this topic?
I mean, I suppose I always quite enjoyed kind of fantasy literature, which as you say, is often quite medieval
adjacent.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. But no, I don't think there was. Although it was purely accidental, I started my undergraduate degree the year after Braveheart came out. I remember early first year lectures in Scottish history where the lecturer had to spend significant time telling the students of all the things that were wrong with Braveheart in terms of accuracy, which took quite a while. So I don't think I have anything like that. But yes, I think, you know, the depiction of medieval events, whether that's on TV, in film, in comics, and various medium, I think mediums certainly does provide a pathway into it for people. Although, of course, that can be dangerous as well.
Now, where I lived in Durham, it was at sort of north of Durham in a little village called Chesley Street. And it had been there for, you know, since the 12th century, basically. Mm. And I'd go out the cottage door, and I'd see a castle. Like, it'd be like right in the backyard. At least I could see it from the backyard. It was Lumley Castle. And it was weird because I grew up in California and our oldest building is like 1977 or something like that. And I mean, you can go to the missions and see older buildings, but it's nothing like going to your backyard and seeing a castle. And so I'm just kind of curious, like you growing up in Scotland, you know, you would just see a castle here and again on the landscape, I'm imagining.
Yes, I mean, although I have to say, yes, I did quite, maybe that was one of my entryways into medieval history. I did like to visit castles and things, historic monuments generally. My part of the world where I grew up, less so. The kind of greater Glasgow area only has one medieval castle, I think. So you had to go slightly further afield to come across mm-hmm. medieval monuments. But yes, we do have a good amount of still standing structures, particularly castles, churches and cathedrals and things.
Okay, so that leads me into a question. Now, I didn't give you this ahead of time. I just got this question about 10 minutes ago from a listener. Okay. This is from Darby. Darby writes, "In my imagination, I blame Disneyland. I think of medieval kings and queens as living in magnificent castles with 200-foot-high turrets and moats and drawbridges. But when I read Beowulf, I get the notion that lots of medieval kings were little more than town mayors with great halls and a big table. Which fantasy is closer to reality?"
I mean, I suppose the latter is more accurate for the early Middle Ages. You know, when kings were warriors first, and I suppose kings second, when, you know, that their role was to form bands of armed men around them and to lead them into battle, and when the culture was very much infused with the various elements surrounding mm-hmm. that included, you know, keeping your men close, rewarding them, giving them food, feasting and things like that. So, I mean, that is certainly part of it. I think the Disney-esque castle is far more a romanticized version of the 18th or the 19th century rather than the Middle Ages. But I mean, my period of study is a bit more advanced than the Beowulf example. You know, as the later Middle Ages go on, kings do want to build themselves nicer, bigger castles. Particularly, they invest in castles which have more room for apartments and for accommodation, not just for defence. And they build things that are, you know, they lavish a lot of money on in order to show off to visitors. And those visitors will be invited in for feasts and events. Which you know, conspicuous consumption is very much a part of what mm-hmm. medieval kings are about, to demonstrate part of their power to their subjects, but also to visiting dignitaries.
You know, when I think of, like, let's say Edinburgh, if you're in certain parts of the city and you look up to the castle, it does look like it's 200 feet high.
Yeah.
Right? Just because of the geography of it. And I'm sure that that's intentionally designed because you don't, you know, you want to limit any sort of invading army. You want to limit the direction that they can actually attack, right?
Mm. Mm. Yeah, I mean, Edinburgh is a particular example. Sat there on top of that extinct volcano, it's you're right, you can see it from pretty much anywhere in the city. I suppose that the perspective that Edinburgh gives today as well, though, is because it's still effectively a base for military forces. And so it's been built up over the centuries. So what you see today is the accumulation of several centuries of building and rebuilding and refortification. So a lot of it is representative of the 17th, 18th, 19th century rather than the 14th century. And something similar can be seen somewhere else, like Stirling, which is another castle on top of a hill that you can see from miles around. And Historic Scotland repainted the Great Hall in a quite bright colour to represent what it might have looked like in the 15th century, and you can literally see it from miles away. But yes, it's slightly similar. Again, you have a castle that started off as a medieval castle, which would have been relatively simple at its outset, but which has been added to over the centuries. So yes, what you're seeing today is the accumulation of that over a long period of time.
So when people are watching House of the Dragon and they see King's Landing, and King's Landing just looks like this. I mean, it really does look like a castle out of fantasy literature more than medieval history. I mean, would there be examples of something that was that grandiose on the landscape of, you know, 14th century Europe?
Well, I suppose, though, that King's Landing is an interesting example because, you know, the castle itself is part of a wider set of defenses, or else I've always seen it that way. You know, it's there is the town itself, which is walled, and then there's the castle at its at its kind of heart. And I think, you know, as time goes on, medieval cities, as they develop, will have those types of defenses. You will certainly get that on the continent with the building of urban walls to protect the town or the city, and then with a prominent fortification at its heart. I was also thinking of somewhere like Dover, although it's different in terms of it's not a city, but it has multiple levels of fortification dating back to even to Roman times and extending right the way through history. But again, that kind of multi-layered defense with a big keep at the center, which is what the main castle at King's Landing is quite like, you know, is not unheard of. It's perhaps a particularly, as you say, a glamorized example. But at its heart, it's not necessarily as different as all that.
Right. Thinking about like Dragonstone, that's completely surrounded by water. And I mean, every now and again, you'll get a castle that is strategically located because of geography, like for instance, Durham Castle has it's basically a peninsula. There's a river that's basically on almost that goes all the way, loops all the way around it. It makes it more difficult to get at it. But I'm also thinking of every now and again, you'll find a castle that is either oceanside or when the tide comes in, it's completely surrounded by water. Can you think of anything that's a little bit like Dragonstone?
I think one of the ones I suppose I thought of were some of the ones on the Northumbrian coast. I mean, you do get various kind of coastal castles. Actually, one of the ones in Scotland would be Dunstaffnage. It's not like a massive fortress or anything, but it does have that location on the coast. It's built on top of this kind of plug of natural rock, and it always looks, when you look up at it, it's like it grows out of the natural stone.
Sure,
you struggle to see where the castle starts and where the rock ends. And there are castles dotted around the Scottish coast, which are quite similar as well. But we do also have up here, we have island castles as well. I was recently at Lochindorb Castle, which is situated, you were referring before we started to Nethy Bridge, it's near there, and it's in a loch, it's on an island in a loch in the middle of the Highlands, and is a fantastic location, although I wouldn't like to have been besieged in it as the people who I'm currently studying were over a winter.
Yeah. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Feel about indiscriminate massacres?
If you're gonna do a massacre, I think it should be indiscriminate.
Otherwise, it's not a massacre. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess so, right? Because I guess you could, when it's all said and done, the more methodical a massacre,
it turns into mass murder at some point.
Yeah, right. I mean, if it's indiscriminate and feels more like a melee, and I think a melee, there should be a melee defense in court. Your Honor, what we're talking about here, it's more than just a semantic argument. The prosecution wants to paint this picture as a massacre when we're just looking at a melee.
So yeah, melee. Even the word even sounds a little bit more benign.
Well, because it has "may" in front of it, so it almost seems like, mm-hmm. like it we're not be. Sure.
It may be a melee.
I mean, it's a melee. I mean, it's much easier to be flip about the word melee than massacre.
Yeah, it's
you can't be like softer. It's a massacre. Sure.
Phonetically, it's softer.
Yeah, but a melee, you're like people. And as soon as you've got the jury going, well, I guess. Because maybe it is a bit of a melee, huh? And that you don't even have to explain that a melee still could be a bad thing. But what you've done is you've softened it. You've softened the terms, mm-hmm. which is interesting to me because we have sort of a flip-flop of that, right? Like it's a lesser crime for manslaughter than murder.
Yeah, manslaughter sounds so much worse.
Manslaughter. I mean, I guess because the word laughter is sort of embedded in there.
Right. Yeah, right. And I think
just you're a pronunciation away from going, look, it's first degree man's laughter. See, there's an example. Like, and you giggled, and then that, if you get the jury kind of yeah. like, if you go up there and like you intentionally make a mistake, and then they don't know, like you go up there, look, we're talking about first degree man's laughter, and they're like, oh, he doesn't even know how. Like, sorry, I just looked at it the way it is. Crazy word, right? Now you've got the jury on your side going, huh? I never even thought of it that way. I
never thought of that. Yeah,
well, I'm going to really pay attention. I'm going to pay attention to this defense attorney because he's got some fun little things he's teaching me. dude, the prosecutor's so boring. Hasn't been one play on words.
I think as soon as you have people thinking about word choice and not about the murderous event that just happened, you've done some serious jury work with that. So, all right. This is the all right.
Here we go.
There's two ways to look at this episode. Right?
Here we go. This is a slip and slide that is fun until you realize that you've run out of slide and it's just dry grass.
until you've run out of slide and you realize it's dragon fire and murder.
Yeah, they're like,
for the next 50 minutes.
They're like, okay, now there's a kiddie pool of water that this is going to dump into. Oh, wait. Or was it hot diarrhea? Jeez. Well, I guess we'll find out once we get there.
I feel like, okay, there's two ways to look at this. One is, you could look at this as the penultimate episode to the entire series, in which case we might talk about, like, historically the way that episode nines would usually function.
Sure.
And boy, there were a lot of, you know, prominent deaths in this episode, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how it can, you know, set up for the final episode. But normally, the penultimate episodes of Game of Thrones have been, I mean, that's a pretty high bar, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Sure.
And I think in a lot of ways, this penultimate episode was, it had some things going for it. It had some fatal flaws. The other way you can look at this is that you can say, okay, this was the episode that everyone hated. Like, everybody hated. And so then the question is, was it hate worthy?
Right.
So which one do you want to do first here?
Let's do the first, and then let's talk about was it hate worthy second.
All right. Okay. I'll tell you what. The first, I would say, first 20 minutes of this episode was brilliant. I mean, and I was just making notes and callbacks and themes that are coming to fruition and, you know, reversal of fortunes between key characters and amazing acting performances. And of course, you're going to hear me wish that that was its own episode.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought everything from Varys writing his letter until, like, Tyrion and Jaime saying goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was all A+.
Okay.
I loved every bit of it. What comes after that is just full-on battle, massacre, chaos, and I think that the elements that really gave this a low score happened in the, let's say, the last two-thirds of this episode.
Which is a full episode, essentially.
Which is really the penultimate episode, right?
Yeah, so. Because if you've added the 20 minutes, and you like the first 20, you didn't like this episode, essentially.
That's right. So that was my sense of it, and I'm so you were you.
So you're
you
know, back.
You were built up in a very strange way for this.
Sure
episode.
Was.
You were built up thinking, this is going to be so bad, I might actually like it.
Yeah. What did I tell you my worst fear was out of all of this? Do you remember?
That you'd walk away and say, it was fine.
Yeah.
That's how you feel?
My worst fear came true.
Yeah. No, that was the worst thing that could have happened.
Right.
And honestly, the fact that it wasn't worse made it worse for you.
For sure. For sure.
It's not a position I've ever encountered before.
It's so bizarre because I couldn't. And so we talked about, like, ways that the last two episodes were improved for me. So I had a better experience than most. Right. So I turned on Vivid on my TV and then digitally removed the Starbucks cup. So two of the major qualms I didn't experience. So I'm experiencing something different. So now I'm also experiencing this episode differently than everybody else was. When you're tuning in and you have all your watch parties and you've canceled plans and you've probably made a whole day out of it. It's probably like a Super Bowl type thing, right? You know, you have 2 weeks of this and you're all fired up. You've got casual fans that you brought into the fray, people that have been sort of like, I watched a few episodes, I'm trying to catch up. Right. You know, people talking and theorizing all day over, you know, gin and tonics.
On Reddit forums. Yeah. Listening to podcasts.
And then the first 20 minutes are gone and people are like, okay, all right. Now we're cooking. And then it happens. And now I'm sure you've got people just kind of stunned and doing like a what the hell. And cause you know, can't pause it. Right. As far as I imagine, right. You're watching it live. and they're just soaking it all. And so I don't have that. I have, hey, you're about to get super disappointed. And I'm like, well, we'll see. So, so I have what not everybody else had, which was, I mean, even the night before I watched this, I was doing an outdoor comedy show with a guy who started it right around the same time I did. And then he finished it a while ago. He just sort of went for it, right? He wasn't bound by the rules of podcasting. And so he's, you know, he was a reluctant viewer. So he was kind of into it, but I don't, you know, and his take was, where are you at? I said, oh, I got two episodes left. He's like, oh, dude, you're going to hate him. And cool. It's like, I can't get anything. I mean, I can't get one person to be like, hey, you might be surprised. I haven't heard one person. And so now I'm built up in a way that everybody in the opposite of the way everybody else is built up. Everybody else is like, here it comes. I'm so excited. This is like Christmas. And I'm over here going, yeah, let's see how bad it is. And I'm like, oh, it's okay. I did like the first 20 minutes. I felt like it was effective. There were some issues I had, which is Tyrion letting Jaime go after he already had to basically tell the Unsullied guard, I'm going to go in there. And so it's like, well, that's the brother. He went in there and I was just gone. And then it was never seemed to be mentioned again. Like nobody was like, oh crap, do you have the Kingslayer? No, I thought you had the Kingslayer. Like there was none of that, right? He just goes and Tyrion's already on thin ice. You think that Jaime Lannister, the reason why she didn't have him killed, Danny Dam killed is because he's some sort of leverage, right? Or he's either leverage or he's revenge. Andy.
Yeah, my take on that was that Danny is not there. She's a Dragonstone, and she's not going to show up with her Dragonstone a lot later. So Tyrion's kind of the guy in charge at this encampment. So who are you going to go complain to? Like, hey, the Kingslayer's gone. You're not going to complain to anyone that has any rank over Tyrion.
No, and that's true. But also, it's like, then why didn't she cooked Varys? She threatens Tyrion with just the fact that Jaime was even caught. What's your end game with Jaime? Why, you know, Danny's cooking fools now. So why did she keep him?
I think that Tyrion knows he's going to get cooked. I think, but then why? Just like, yeah. I'm going to do it. I got to do it because this is like the 1%. Possibility of ending this thing.
Yeah, I don't necessarily have a problem with his motivation, I guess, but I'm just thinking like I thought there'd be a little bit more immediate fallout because at some point they're like, dude, he's gone.
Let's talk about the major issue. All right. The major issue that I think most people that hated this episode were upset with what happened with Danny. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, she just keeps murdering and murdering and murdering and murdering. I mean, it goes on forever.
Right.
It's like, can we get a reprieve? I mean, I just like a little Hannibal Lecter moment would actually feel like a reprieve at this point. It's like, at least with Hannibal Lecter, we got a little, you know, break between murders. I feel like in the same way that people didn't like Jaime shunning Brienne and going back to his hateful life with Cersei. Hmm. I think people were thinking, no, we have too much invested in Danny's ultimate salvation that we don't want to view her as a villain. And in this episode, she goes full villain, right?
Yeah.
And I kind of felt like they had dropped a lot of hints along the way.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So first things first, for me, is that did you watch the before on Game of Thrones?
No, montage? I didn't. We usually don't, okay. But I considered it just because I noticed. I think I watched a couple and realized that it doesn't just tell you what happened right before. It's sort of trying to tie you in to give you breadcrumbs to where you're headed.
Right. I think I really think that that's what they were trying to do with that particular.
And it's interesting they started doing this later in the seasons, which kind of suggests we aren't going to do as much as we have in the past to sort of fill in those blanks. So guys, here's some, you know, cheat sheet. Here's some notes for you guys.
Well, it's kind of like
nice. Actually, it's not a terrible thing. Cause there's a lot.
If you weren't following the conversations between Varys and Tyrion up until this point where it's like, hey, you know what? she could be crazy. She could
right.
You know, she could go into a murderous rage, just like her father or whatever. Then what they did for that previously on Game of Thrones little portion is they went back and they talked. There were like tons of little clues that they replayed. You got to hear like people say, well, you know what they say about the Targaryens, the gods slip a coin.
Right.
50% of the time, these guys come out as the Mad King. And you almost went back to, they actually went back to her older brother who said, you don't want to wake the dragon.
Right.
And that's kind of how they ended, kind of, I thought, effectively telling us, hey, guess what? You're about to wake the dragon.
Yeah.
And you're going to see something that we've been hinting at, but it's going to be a whole dragon.
Did they do the Lady Olenna be a dragon moment?
They didn't do that one. No, which
I think is pretty valuable, because I think that there is something. Mm-hmm. I think what's really cool about that particular sequence is, you know, it's woman to woman.
Yeah.
That's right. It is appealing to her power. It's appealing to her, you know, best. It appeals a lot to the thing. And, you know, and meanwhile, like, you could make the argument, like, well, Lady Olenna's about to die, you know, pretty eventually, yeah, right? Yeah. So what's her advice?
And Dany really hasn't had any motherly figures in her life.
Right.
Like not ever.
Yeah, yeah. And there certainly aren't any women in her life, with the exception of lady like Miss Sandy, that are saying, you got this. You know, everything else is like, ah, you know, let's validate. Mm-hmm. You need to be validated through marriage, all these different things. And she's like, I want to break the wheel. And the only way to break the wheel is on my terms. And all these men who are still sort of tied to their families or tied to tradition, they're really not that interested in seeing the wheel broken.
I think that we found out what she means by the wheel is murder everyone.
Yes, 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 yes.
I want to. It's just shorthand. Break the wheel means murder everyone.
So fair to say that one of the larger objections, as I think you mentioned, is, hey, we've been all in on this idea that Danny's going to make everything better, and this is significantly worse. So do people feel like, well, then what were you doing? Why, like, did if they feel like, oh, well, this is just a misdirection for misdirection's sake. Like, hey, you ran out of cool ideas. Mm-hmm. You didn't know how to end it. So let's just flip the expectation. Is that the thought? That what some of the reaction was? Or
I think some people were like, really like curious, like, this can't be what you had planned all along, was it? And
see, I really think it was. I mean,
I think it was, and I think that this was part of George Martin's overall outline. Even simple things like in George Martin's world, super blonde hair bespeaks someone that you can't trust. Mm. Now, there are exceptions, of course, because Tyrion's supposed to have super platinum hair or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think that, I mean, even little things like that, little things, you know, all the way back to season one, where it's like, she burned that witch. Like,
yeah, yeah.
That witch, Miri Mazdoor had a great, she had actually a great point, you know? And she was defending herself and her tribe, and Danny just like, no, I'm going to burn you alive.
Yeah, her issues in that, you know, I mean, like, she crucified all the leaders, and there was this, like, there was some pushback from that.
She didn't just lock Doxos von Duxos or whatever.
Right, yeah.
She didn't just lock him in his own vault. She locked one of her own servant girls.
Yeah, yeah.
In that vault. So, I mean, she can be cold-blooded.
And it's interesting because you compare it, like, to Cersei, right? And there's this, and I think the show did a really good job of this because for people to not see that means that the show is doing a pretty good job of sort of, I think, juxtaposing those types of things with something worse by somebody else, mm-hmm. so that it's easy to kind of forget those moments. And then you sort of, because you've decided, and this is, I think, a fascinating concept of how the world of Game of Thrones, like the meta part of it, is if you're inclined to be on someone's side, you're inclined to be on their side. So you're going to see her locking Duxos away and being like, yeah, that's what you get. But if Cersei takes the Dornish woman and poisons her daughter and everything. And even if you don't like that particular person, that is so over the top cruel that you're like, geez, man, Cersei's a monster. It's like, well, okay, how is that? That's not that different from the other part, right? I mean, and I think that that's where maybe, and this is me maybe critiquing the average fan. I don't know. I'm sure a message board will hate me at some point, when that's the hope, right? To get to be message board worthy. But the idea that, like, well, just because you weren't paying attention doesn't mean that this ending so far is bad. You know, just because you were like, well, I didn't.
Yeah, I think that the other part of it was there's a certain, on the critical side of it, it's like there's a critique of, oh, so we can't have a woman president because she's going to.
Sure. Yeah.
She's going to snap. She's going to go crazy and press the nuclear bomb. Is that what you're saying?
You know, that right. Kind of. And I think that, and so here's the thing about expectation, right? And I think that this is something that has felt like it potentially was a very pro-feminist show, and to some degree. I mean, obviously there's a lot of other hateful,
harmful
things.
Well, we had even
things.
Made that. Yeah, we'd even made that observation. Like, who do we have? Well, we have Yara, we have Sansa, we have Arya, we have
Cersei,
Dany, we have Cersei. Like, there was a lot of powerful queens in this show, right?
Right. And so, and if Martin, and again, this is and the showrunners, and this is again maybe doing a close reading and bailing out that which doesn't need to be bailed out, or making excuse, because again, this could be the same kind of thing, the same critique that I'm giving on the fan who's like, well, I've been excusing Danny's behavior when really it's been pretty bad because I've been thinking that she's still good. I could be doing the same thing for, like, hey, you gave me, you know, 7.5 seasons of absolute magic. I'm going to try to bail you guys out, and maybe you don't deserve it on these endings. But I think there's something to be said for the idea of pursuit of power, right? And that's how I've been seeing the Game of Thrones being a lesson, or at least that's the sort of the moral of the story, right? Is this pursuit of power, and the idea that, like, oh, well, now switching over to women, it'll get better. It's like, why do you think that fighting for power is somehow better if we swap the genders? The idea that it's that power won't corrupt anybody is sort of a foolish notion. And I think that there's a long game that you could say is being played here, where you're just like, okay, cool, this is going to be a woman empowering thing. Now, again, the critique could be like, well, she just snapped. Well, but so did the Mad King. The suggestion being that it didn't matter who was at the throne. The power, you either are going to be lazy with power, which makes you dangerous, or you're going to be drunk with power, which makes you dangerous. The problem is the power.
I mean, I think it's even worse than that. I think that they set this up as these Targaryens think that they're a higher form of life. Like, they are higher species. They have magic blood. They don't think that they are ruled by the same ethics of everyone else. And they think that by the virtue of their birth, they should rule everyone else.
Right.
That's not someone that I want to root for.
Exactly. No, and I think so. And to the point where we saw it firsthand, when as soon as Jon Snow threatens that, because if she believes that, if that's a Targaryen belief, and then he comes along and it's like, well, now I don't like you because if I believe this, then I have to believe this of you.
That's right.
And if I have to believe this of you, I actually have to be subservient to you. And I've come too far to do that. I don't bend the knee. Knees bend to me. And I would rather have my own, either my nephew needs to just deal with it and become my, you know, my first man or whatever. It's, I don't know. I think I could argue that this is, it's abrupt.
Well, all right. I'm glad that you said that word, abrupt. Do you think that this season would have been helped by a little bit slower pacing and maybe one more episode that leads to Dany's ultimate dark side or something like that?
I do. I think you can. I think if you made this a full, I know, I understand that there's this, the idea of, like, well, maybe the time wise, it still is a full season, but I think there's something to be said for making it a full 10 episodes that are even 60 minutes long, because it sort of forces you to create an arc per episode. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think by shortening it to six, even though you've made each episode longer, the arcs that you normally deal with from episode to episode, you've actually got less of those. And you find out how important those are, because those become little like stepping stones to the final part of the season. And in this case, it makes it even more necessary, I think, to have more stepping stones. So in this case, you have five stepping stones to a finale. And that's half, even if it's more time that you're spending per episode. Like, you could easily have turned this episode into two. I get the idea that she was burning the city. I don't know that I need to keep seeing her burn the city to get the idea. Oh, and guess what? I don't know if people cared about, as much about a Hound versus Mountain battle enough to draw that out. And so that's, it's, to me, that was, those are the kind of miscalculations where you're like, this the same argument that we have is like, how do you follow up the Long Night with getting back to the intrigue of the throne? And they did it, you know, and there were some issues with that episode, but they pulled it off. The idea that you are going to embed in this carnage when we're all just kind of wrestling with, whoa, Danny's the bad guy? And then you're like, oh, but let's see how the Hound gets back at his brother. I'm like, I don't care. Like, that is, at that time, that is not the time or place for that. And to make it,
I remember thinking that too. I think that my rewatch, I was kind of more into the Clegane Bowl than I was in the first time around.
Well, and that, probably because you had, since you already knew what was going to happen and you sort of reconciled with that, it's easier to watch some of the peripheral, right? So that's the thing, is I'm in the midst of watching this massive character shift and dealing with the fallout of that and watching, you know, innocents die. And then, so at this point you're like, well, why do I have to care more about whether or not the Hound gets his revenge on his brother when I'm watching mothers being slain in the street?
I did feel that way about the Jamie Euron battle.
Yeah. The thing nobody asked for.
I was like, what, wait, why do I care about this?
Right. And so that's another, I think it was a bit of a miscalculation that could have maybe still been done if you took more time throughout the season, because at this point it's like, you could have cooked Euron and that'd have been it for me, and I'm fine. The idea,
right, that you sent me a text, you said there are a lot of songs that mention whippoorwills.
Yes.
That was not the one I was thinking of.
It's true though,
there are, in fact, there's a song about a whippoorwill that I don't even think you've heard. I'm going to send it to you.
I imagine. I was just looking up how many songs mention whippoorwills, and there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot of songs that have whippoorwill in the title. First off, whoa. I mean, is this now, you want to talk about underrated, overrated, or aptly rated whippoorwill? I would have said before, dude, that's got to be underrated. But now that I realize how many songs mention them, I'm like, maybe we're giving this bird a little too much.
Whippoorwill is like, it's a word that contains an alliteration. I mean, honestly, it's, I'm not sure if it's onomatopoeia, but I'm willing to.
I think it is. Last night, I listened to the cry of the whippoorwill, and it does sound like whippoorwill, whippoorwill. Anyway.
Yeah, there you go. You said, okay, that episode has multiple issues, big issues, but not so bad. So, all right, let's talk about the big issues. We've definitely talked about a couple.
Yeah, yeah.
What were your big issues?
I did have a problem with, Heather was like, why is Tyrion have to say his bell plan this many times? It felt a bit like, first off, she didn't think it was a good plan. Mm-hmm. And I kind of agreed that it was like, all right, Tyrion keeps gripping, and maybe that's part of the, maybe that's part of the necessary narrative, but I think I saw the Dany turn coming, but the Tyrion erosion into just sort of kind of flailing plans. I'm going to defend it in the second, but I'm also going to say my visceral reaction. To me, that was the bigger disappointment in terms of what a show was doing to a character, in order to what I felt move the plot along. That said, you know, we've been talking about the growing naivete of Tyrion over the last few episodes. And the idea that he is gripping for the sake of the Lannisters. Maybe King's Landing is more than just the people of King's Landing, and it is more of the Lannister family. And that matters more to him than we realize. But it just doesn't seem like the guy who shoots his dad on the toilet gets to that point, right? Like it's, I could see him going darker than I could see him softening towards the Lannisters, I guess. So that part becomes,
if I understand you right, you think that his, what's your issue with him repeating his plan, the Bell plan again?
Well, first off, I think the plan's kind of wonky.
Tell me more about wonky.
I don't know why he thinks it's going to work. I mean, and I don't know why everybody's on board with it, or at least seeming to be.
You think that even after he pitches it to Danny and she says yes, that he should be smart enough to know
yes
that it's not going to work.
Right. I don't know why. And I guess that's sort of, but there is a part of it that does work in kind of looking back, which is the sense of he's got no moves left. And so all he has is hope. And even the Varys and him moment is like, even Varys says, well, I hope I'm wrong, because if I'm wrong, then she is the right leader.
I hope I deserve this. Truly, I do. I hope I'm wrong.
And
that's right.
And so there,
and I've betrayed the right leader.
Right. And so that I think, and so I guess the Tyrion thing, it seems like it's frustrating on one hand, but maybe it's supposed to be frustrating, is that he's just, he doesn't have a plan to thwart this. And I think there's, you know, here I am, I'm about to defend Weiss and Benioff in my critique. Tyrion's us. Tyrion's the viewer. We've been following this queen's trajectory, thinking she's the right one. She's the right one. Mm-hmm. And even as things started to fall apart, we're like, yeah, but I mean, she's still the right one. I can forgive this. Oh, you know, burning the Tarleys, that was pretty rough. But like, hey.
No, she's better than Cersei for sure.
She's better than Cersei. So we do that. So you start going through this, right? And then so you're like, and then he's like, ah, you know, he's gripping. He's like, no, this is fine. This is fine. He's a little dog in the burning house. This is fine. I can fix it. I can fix it. And then so we defend it, and we defend her, and we defend her, and we defend her. And then she burns everything down, and we're like, oh my God, was I an idiot for following into this? And so there is, I guess there is a sense that Tyrion's decay almost is a meta decay for us, right, as fans.
Well, perhaps. Here's a character that has, you know, famously been a cynic, right? And then he chooses to put his faith in this sort of god woman, you know, Greek goddess, basically. And it turns out that she's a monster.
Right.
And I thought, okay, that's interesting. I mean, that's interesting to me. The other thing that's interesting to me, and I don't know if this is just my reading or whether this was intentional, but remember way back in the day when Jaime was having that final conversation with Tyrion when Tyrion was going to be executed? And we talked about how the bells kind of corresponded to Cousin Orson's thudding or whatever.
Right.
Well, the bells open up a conversation about how the gods are unpredictable. I wonder if there's something of a parallel here. It's like he's put his faith in this Greek goddess, and she's turned out to be a monster. And after all, like, what are really the difference between gods and monsters?
Right.
And so I wonder if the bells sort of have some sort of symbolic import.
So the bell rings, and well,
it's Tyrion putting his unjustified faith in a goddess.
Well, and weren't the bells ringing at his, to say, his trial and his his pending execution.
That's right.
So the bells here, which is supposed to be the surrender, in a way, does that very thing again. It's the bells.
That's exactly
indicate.
Right.
Yeah. So symbolically, and this is a good conversation. So I guess here's the thing, right? So I mean, overall, I'm like watching. I don't have a problem with her. I mean, obviously, I have a problem with her burning everybody down. I know that I've already been on record saying child sacrifices. There's a time and a place.
You just wish that Shireen was around.
I wanted her to be resurrected so she could get burned again. I didn't feel like betrayed by this character. I felt like, this is kind of where we're going.
So you're different, because a lot of people felt betrayed by it. A lot of people felt like, I don't like what you're saying about women.
Sure. No, and that critique is fair. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that was the point, right? I think it was a necessary dupe. Mm-hmm. Because the bigger critique isn't about men in power. It's about power. You know, and it's about and putting your faith in somebody with power and following them despite their clear
and
failings.
Danny's proven that power is everything, right? It's not about the rightful leader of the throne. If that was the case, it'd be Jon, right?
Right.
it's not about, you know, saving the innocents or whatever, breaking the wheel. That's not her. Her thing is power.
She had a great
line.
That
is the story that they were telling.
And her great line, I think, was when she talks about how, you know, yeah, there's tens of thousands of innocents, but I'm talking about saving generations to come. And these are the eggs you got to break to make that omelet. Mm. And I think that's how people in power, man or woman, convince themselves that the atrocities that they allow or even create, it's for the greater good.
Mm-hmm. But I think that the show would have been better if they had taken that extra episode, better established a little bit of empathy for Dani. I would rather have her end as a conflicted character where you're like, I can kind of see her point of view. Like, I can kind of see why she made the decisions that she made, rather than everyone turning on her at the end, like, oh, whoa, she's a monster.
Right. No, I
so
get
I,
it.
I mean, I there's a lot of monsters in this show. I mean, you could say Littlefinger is certainly a monster. Mm-hmm. You could say that a lot of people are monsters. But you still, this show's really good at taking someone like Jamie and then creating empathy for that character. Mm-hmm. I would have liked to see like one more episode here in the middle that really establishes Dani's point of view so that she's making a calculated decision rather than like, go, she's going crazy at the end.
Yes, you know? I guess I feel like that was okay for me. And maybe it's because, and I do think it was abrupt. I do think that there was a lot that could be, that it would have benefited from. Mm-hmm. From fleshing that out a little bit more, but
sure.
And again, I do have a different viewing experience than others, also because we do this type of postmortem, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that there were lots of fan boards and all these different things that people could discuss. But we talked a lot about the false altruism of Dani.
And
I thought the show. So on one hand, you're like, "Hey,"
and I'll be honest, I did that on purpose,
and I'm sure you did. But I didn't feel like you were leading the witness, because I was like, I was seeing that. I saw it.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah. I mean,
a little bit leading the witness. I mean, I was kind of like, these are things that I was noticing on the rewatch, mm-hmm. and thinking, actually, they're laying a pretty good track.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I think it, and yeah, maybe you let it, maybe, you know, I don't, but I mean, it was pretty clear to me that, so when you say maybe one more episode, I'm like, if you want a benefit of the doubt of her perspective, I watched it the moment we saw her. We mm-hmm. went through her whole journey and what she's had to go through. And there, those breadcrumbs, they were laid pretty well. Mm-hmm. And so when Lady Olenna says, be a dragon, I'm like, that's a problematic statement. And that one stuck with me a lot, because I'm like, mm-hmm. well, what do dragons do?
Yeah. Dragons eat whoever they want. Right. That's what dragons do.
They
right?
don't consult Tyrion. So that to me, that was the turning point for me.
So like I said, I really like the beginning of this episode. Here are the things that major things that didn't work for me in the second half. And the first is just a really simple one. Like, I don't believe that the Lannisters have 300 scorpions.
Right.
And are only using three of them.
They have 300 scorpions, and they also have really ornate lion heads on them, I feel like.
They went to a lot of trouble to really put the detail work into the scorpions.
My criticism of the 1989 Batman
is...
Gosh, the Joker's marketing team is real fast. They work really fast. I mean, to get logos, to get helicopters fitted with the logos, mm-hmm. to get a helicopter. I mean, there's so many different aspects of, like, everything is branded immediately. And,
you know what? It wasn't going to be the Joker. He just happened to have a friend who had all of this kind of, like, he was like a DJ and his nickname was the Joker. And
right.
He had all this junk laying around. He's like, I've got this merch. I don't know. You might decide to just use this, because I'm not using the nickname anymore.
I mean, there's where does he get those wonderful toys? Like, dude, you have a flower that shoots acid. You have fake teeth that are on like a fishing string that can hold your weight like a bungee cord. You're doing okay, bro.
You got some toys, man.
You got balloons filled with Smilex. So I will say, like, that was a little thing that sort of put me off was as soon as I see the scorpion with like this, you know, adorned lion's head on it, I'm like, that was a priority, huh?
Yeah, it's more of a priority to get the lion head on there than to actually get 200 people to man the scorpions on the wall. Like,
right.
How many unmanned scorpions do you have?
Yeah.
This dragon comes out of nowhere. Are you only pointing the scorpions one direction?
Right. Like, why wouldn't you just say, okay, look, here's how we're going to position
them. Have you put blinders on all of the soldiers?
Right.
So they can only look in one direction.
If we position them all in a certain way and we launch at the same exact time, there's nowhere in the air she can be. You know what I mean? Like, there's that kind of concept, too. If you have that many. Basically, it's the Star Wars defense, the Reagan Star Wars defense. That's what you have. So that was really, like, they all were like, shoot one direction. Great.
So I could overlook that. I mean, it was one of those things. It's like
Here's the thing. You could figure she's better at navigating now that she expects it. Maybe, right?
Yeah. No, I put up with a lot of stormtrooper fire. I could probably deal with this.
And you know, when you come face to face with the dragon, you think you can scorpion a dragon's skull in the basement. But man,
okay. And in all right, so in defense of the scorpion, when they took down Rhaegal. Rhaegal was kind of wounded. Like they did tell us, like, he's injured, but he's gonna be fine. And he's not 100%.
Right. We didn't even know if he'd live to be.
And Drogon is just, you know, Drogon is he's a super duper beast
dragon.
Or whatever. Yeah, he's a dragon.
He's a good dragon.
Okay. The other thing that that was a pretty major for me was. Okay, so Dany's upset, and she's like, you've seen a lot of work on her face. Like, she's trying to communicate, like, I'm pretty pissed, and I'm just going to keep killing people until I'm not pissed. But she goes for Cersei last.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, if you're pissed at Cersei, why not just go for Cersei?
Yeah, she's not in a corn maze. She's on a dragon.
Yeah, so what happens is she's pissed at Cersei, and so what she thinks is, I think I'm going to kill 1,000 people indiscriminately before I go for Cersei.
That she probably doesn't even care about, right?
And, I mean, and how does she know that Cersei's not, like, running away? Like,
right.
Like, if you want to kill Cersei, go kill Cersei.
Well, so here's a defense of that, and this is right. That's a loose defense. One, she going a little cuckoo.
Yeah, that's the story that they're trying to tell, right?
But also, she's been getting a lot of advice that she's sort of over. And one of those is, if you kill everybody, you're just as bad as Cersei.
You're just as bad as the Mad King.
Whatever you do, don't kill everybody. So to the point where you start feeding it enough to where if you're getting tired of people telling you what to do, and the one thing they keep telling you right now is that you are a monster if you do this, you might be like, you know what?
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna get back at you too. I'll do what I want, because if I don't, then I'm showing deference to you, mm-hmm. and you're supposed to show deference to me. Mm-hmm. So the other part of that is where. She wants to ruin Cersei on every level. The whole point of her agreeing to the original or to the second negotiation was, hey, if I end up having to kill people because of war, let everybody they'll all know Cersei had the chance to save him and she didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the other side of it, right? So Cersei's legacy or whatever, she's like, I also have to protect myself on this throne. And so if people can look back and, hey, why do we think that Dany is better? Because Cersei was worse. That was sort of the false justification we told ourselves.
Yes.
So if she goes in there and she does, she's like, hey, if I kill you, Cersei could have stopped it, but she didn't. So Cersei's still worse somehow.
That's right.
So yeah. That's my sort of like, okay with it logistically, you know, strategically, no, it's a dumb move. But there's also the sense of like, if I wipe out all of her scorpions and I wipe out a good chunk of her people and all of her army, and then she survives, what's she gonna do? what is she going to do? You know what I get to do? I get to put her, worst case, I capture her, put her on trial for the death of everybody that I just killed. You know, there is a, I think that, again, am I making the justification? Sure. But I mean, that's all I got. That's all we have. We've been doing close readings of this.
Yeah, I guess. I guess I'm thinking, like, if the story that they're trying to tell is that she's in a fit of rage and she snaps, and I think that is the story that they're trying to tell, which they've told that story with Jon Snow before. When Battle of the Bastards, he kind of turns into like this animal creature on the battlefield, and he comes up over this ridge and he sees Ramsay. Mm-hmm. And he's just animal-like. And like the after the episode features, that was the language that they used. Like, he just snapped. And all he could see was Ramsay and how he was going to murder Ramsay. Okay, so that's fine. Is she calculating and she wants this end game with Cersei that's dramatic and all of that business? Or is she enraged and wants vengeance? Because if it's the second thing, and I think that that's what they're trying to say, then go right for Cersei. You know? See, laser beam focus on Cersei.
And maybe that's what the showrunners have said, is that this was a fit of rage. I guess I saw it as less. I saw it as both. I saw it as a fit of rage fueled by exasperation. I didn't see her as snapping. And maybe that's my own problem. Maybe that was what I was supposed to see.
Yeah.
I saw her sitting there. To me, was like, I'm ready to snap. Okay, now I'm allowing myself to snap. That's kind of what I saw.
Maybe that's different. I've been holding back the dragon.
Yeah. And I'm like, you know what? Like, she had a moment. She's like I felt it was calculated. I felt it was enraged, but I felt like she knew what she was going to do when she got on that dragon that morning. That's my thought.
Okay, now I want to tell you about everything I liked about this episode.
Mm-hmm.
But before I do, are there any other major issues that...
So logistics are an issue again. I really, honestly, the Euron Jaime was probably like, I think I had a pause to unroll my eyes. I just didn't, you know, it's like it's amazing to me. And I get it. He's water, you know, he's water dude. So he can survive the water, which then why didn't all the other water dudes survive the water? And he comes in and it's just like, it's this big deal. And again, I think... maybe it just wasn't for me, but this idea that like Jaime, the last time that Jaime disappointed us was he left Brienne, right? Like that was,
yeah, sure.
That was the moment. So him going back to Cersei for whatever, unless he was going back to kill Cersei, I don't think we would have felt that he resolved in a way that we may have wanted it to. Right. So him returning. So then the idea that like, Euron wants his woman. It's like, I don't care. I don't want him and Cersei. I don't want Jaime. Like the idea that like we should be rooting for Jaime because he has to get back to Cersei. It's like, well, we don't want him to get back to Cersei if it's to reunite. You know what I mean? So it's like, why do I care that he's being thwarted in this, what I consider a nothing maneuver, especially if they're already surrendering without him going up there? I thought that was kind of the point. You know, I mean,
right.
Nothing about Jaime getting interrupted mattered because he gets interrupted, but they surrender anyway. So what is it? So that whole notion of him having to get back and Tyrion risking his own life to get his brother to do this thing that he never even needed to do. So when he finally reaches Cersei, everything crumbles and it's like, okay, that's kind of a poetic notion. They get crumbled by the very, castle that they kept.
That's right. I think so.
But it also was like, okay.
Yeah, I think it's okay. So first of all, when the brothers say farewell, I really do believe that they think this is the last time we're going to see each other.
One way or another.
Yeah. So both of them, I think, are resolved to do what they're going to do or die trying.
Mm-hmm.
So Jaime goes to find Cersei. And I think initially it's like, I'm going to take her and we're going to escape.
Mm-hmm.
And then Euron like stabs him pretty good.
Yeah.
And I think he knows he's going to die. And I think at that point he's thinking, well, I'm going to do this anyway. And if I die trying, then I'm going to die trying. And I think maybe he thinks he is going to die. But he's going to die in Cersei's arms or something.
Right.
So I don't know.
Which is also fine, but I don't know that I care.
Yeah, there was something missing there.
Well, and this is, I think this is my, this goes back to my other point about the Clegane's. Don't do that right now. Don't do any of that right now, because you have so much, I have so much that I'm chewing on, that the idea of these lesser incidents don't hold the same level of gravity. and so then that's because that becomes not only the logistical issues we've had, but it's sort of the timing and like the choices that are made. And again, yeah. I think it's a very complicated thing, because how do you have the, so I think what you could do is if you split this up into two episodes, your final scene in this is the bell rings, Tyrion's like, phew, and then she takes off and just starts burning. That's your end, right?
That's your end.
And then your next episode, you can just pick up with her still scorching everything, right? Mm-hmm. Then now we've had enough time to sort of chew on that a little bit, like emotionally.
Yeah, you probably get a whole week of fans saying, oh no, what are we going to do with Danny? What are we going to do with, you know, all of these questions, right?
So now you can shift your attention and you can have these subplots of the Clegane's and then Jamie, and if you have to do Euron, fine. But like, then those scenes, they're separated a bit, right? So then you have that a chance to sort of, to mull them over and chew on them with the sort of gravity that I think that they were intended. So I think that's one of the problems I have, is that they get so overshadowed by the other going on, that it's
let me give you an alternative episode here. What if Danny goes after Cersei like precision strike, and she hits it like a cache of wildfire, and the wildfire takes out the city?
Yeah.
And everyone's like, well, this is just all burned anyway.
Right.
And then you can kind of think, well, you know, I can kind of see that her motive, but, you know, and maybe like there are people out there that are like, no, she burned down the city.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the same way that Jaime gets blamed for killing the Mad King or whatever.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's okay too, I guess. So an interesting part that I thought, like, so we see wildfire eruptions.
Yeah, yeah.
Now that's,
I like that.
Now that's
like
wildfire that's like underneath the city, right?
Yeah, someone hid some wildfire.
Yeah, so I kind of, right? So I think that that's an interesting, to me that was intriguing, because I liked the idea that whether it was there from before or whether it was Cersei's doing, she has that there are these booby traps.
Yeah, yeah.
That are fully there to wipe out the innocents. Because she already did it with the Sept, right? So the idea that she's going, I think that juxtaposition, I don't think it's going to get enough credit, because I love the idea that it's like, yes, Danny's going crazy and burning people, and oh, look, it was going to probably happen one way or another. These people were screwed. You know what I mean? Like, there was, I think that there's something, I think that's a really good element that can easily get lost.
It was a good, nice little detail. I mean, clearly that's not the story that, they could have told that story differently.
Sure.
All right, let me tell you the things that I loved about this episode. Mm. Okay, there was an episode, maybe in season 7, where Tyrion is in Meereen and the dragons won't eat.
Mm-hmm.
And he decides his big plan is to walk into this dark, cavernous dungeon or whatever and free the dragons.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, the way that this episode starts is that Dany won't eat.
Right.
And then Tyrion goes into her dark room. The lighting is exactly the same as Tyrion walking into the dungeon.
Interesting.
And he's really reluctant to go in.
Yeah, yeah.
He's afraid of her. And in other words, she's become the dragon. Right,
right. Right. Yeah, that's a good, again,
I thought that was great.
Little clues.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. That was really, really well done. I really like that when Tyrion walks up to Varys and just says, it was me.
Yeah.
That's all he says. It was me. And then he puts his hand on his, you know. I thought I would have liked to see Varys jump off and grow a merman tail. But aside from that, the way that Varys went out was like, it was really Game of Thrones.
Yeah,
you know. You know, here's Tyrion's, this is his bestie.
Yeah.
And anyway, that was great. I do like when Jon is trying to kiss Dany, or at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I don't have love here. I only have fear.
I love you. And you will always be my queen.
Is that all I am to you?
He's like, is this gonna work?
Right.
Am I gonna be able to forget that you're my aunt? That you've resolved to, you know, commit genocide?
Yeah. As soon as and that scene for me was like, I'm like, nope. Oh, Danny's gonna do whatever she wants now.
Yeah. I don't have any love here, and he says, "I love you." And the way he says, "You're my queen," it's with all the resolve that he would take the Night's Watch vow.
Right.
It's like, look, I'm stuck here, and I'm gonna be loyal. I'm gonna be a man of honor. It's not by a way of affection, and she realizes it.
Yeah, and she says, is that all I am?
Okay, let it be fear.
Let it be fear.
Well, which is an amazing moment, right? Because here she is. She's all about titles, and she wants to be the queen. And then she's like, he's like, yeah, you're my queen. And then she's like, well, is that it? And that's like, well, isn't that everything? And it just shows how conflicted she is. It shows how she's not ready really to be a leader in many ways. And I just think, and at that point I'm like, and again, I have no idea what's going to happen. I mean, I give all my friends credit for not saying anything about this episode, so that when that bell rings and she's sitting there, I'm like, oh dude, it is on. I knew, and I was glad. And let me tell you why I was glad, because I didn't like Tyrion's plan. And I thought it was kind of a contrived idea. And here's what I thought was going to happen is that the bells are going to ring, that Jaime, this is what Heather thought. And I think this is actually would have been a pretty good storyline, is Tyrion constantly is telling, hey, this is the idea. We do the bells, and then we'll back out. And Jaime knows this. He gets to Cersei in time and says, if we ring those bells, they'll fall back and we can attack.
Oh yeah, no,
that's what she thought was going to happen. So that's why she was really frustrated with Tyrion, because she's like, oh, he's just giving his plan away, like he's a Bond villain now. Sure. And then it turned out that wasn't the case. So I was kind of relieved, because I didn't want because that's where I was getting frustrated with Tyrion. I'm like, well, is he going to just tell him how to beat him?
Okay. The other thing I really liked was the exchange between the reversal of fortunes between Jaime and Tyrion. So, you know, this other scene that I've already mentioned was with Jaime sort of visiting Tyrion in jail and then letting him go. And now we got this little reversal of fortunes where Tyrion lets Jaime go. And what's his mission is to save the city from burning, which is exactly what we've been told is what makes Jaime a good guy, because back in the day he killed the Mad King to save the city from burning. And he says something like, you know, I didn't really care about the innocents anyway. So he's kind of trying to talk himself into being the villain.
Right.
When have I ever been able to convince Cersei of anything?
Try. If not for yourself, if not for her, and for every one of the million people in that city, innocent or otherwise.
To be honest, I never really cared much for them. Innocent or otherwise.
You do care for one innocent. I know you do. And so does Cersei. She has her reason now.
The child is the reason she'll never give an inch. All the worst things she's ever done, she's done for her children. It's not impossible that she'll win. She won't. Her enemy's forces have been depleted, as she said they would be. Two of the three dragons are dead. She's even the odds.
The city will fall tomorrow.
She has the Lannister army. She has the Golden
Company. I defended the city last time it was attacked. I know it better than anyone. It will fall tomorrow.
Then I suppose I'll die tomorrow, if not before.
Why?
Escape. The two of you together. Remember where we met? Where they keep the dragon skulls beneath the Red Keep. Take her down there. Keep following the stairways down, down as far as they'll go. You'll come out onto a beach at the foot of the keep. A dinghy will be waiting for you. Sail out of the bay. If the winds are kind, you'll make it to Pentos. Start a new life.
Sail right past the Iron Fleet and into a new life.
Sounds a lot less likely than Cersei winning this war.
There won't be an Iron Fleet for much longer. Do it. If you don't, you'll never see Cersei again. Swear to me. You have my word.
All of that put together, so I've already mentioned the sort of the parallels between the bells and the gods and whatnot. Yeah. All of that put together, and I would say that's about the first 20 minutes of the episode. For that 20 minutes, I didn't care about the Night King. I actually cared about the Iron Throne again.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I
which is
yeah,
a
right.
pretty amazing thing given what we talked about before. Right. It's like, why should I care about the Iron Throne? They just defeated death, right?
Yep. Yep.
And for those for the first 20 minutes of this episode, I actually really cared. I really cared about the Iron Throne. And I thought that that was kind of an impossible feat that they pulled off.
Yeah, yeah.
So I loved all that part of it. I also thought it was a pretty great little set piece to have the gates explode from behind the Golden Company.
Yeah, yeah.
That was kind of great, even though Drogon dodged a bunch of scorpion bolts to do it. I did appreciate the Clegane Bowl a second time through.
Like I said, I don't think I had a problem with it overall, just that in that sequence with everything else going on, it just gets overshadowed. And I don't think,
yeah,
and it kind of, it's like, I just didn't, if I had cared, I forgot. Get this.
Yeah, sure. You know, and here's what I liked about it. All right. So here we have the Mountain, who's like super strong, like superhumanly strong. And at one point he like creates a human shield for like this massive ceiling coming down on Cersei, like totally obedient, right? And then he sees his brother.
Yeah, and he just Qyburn gets
he
tossed.
Just destroys Qyburn and ignores Cersei. It's
which,
like,
which is I'll tell you what, man, I love that. I loved it, you know, as a just the creature turning against creator.
It's exactly. You wanted some Frankenstein stuff.
Yeah,
that was it, right?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And
yeah,
what
yeah.
happens with the Hound at the same time? Here, Cersei is like he could end the war right there. Just stab Cersei. Nope, he doesn't care. He lets Cersei walk right by.
Yeah.
All he can see is his grudge match with his brother and vice versa. So here are these two characters that the world is actually crumbling around them. And all they care about is vengeance.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it sort of culminates with the metaphor of like one of them pokes out one of them's eyes and the other one pokes out the other. So you have that eye for an eye metaphor.
Right, right, right.
And then they both, you know, tumble to their certain death.
Well, and, you know, now that we're having, and again, because I was so taken by all the other stuff and having this postmortem is good because it's like, yeah, and why is the world crumbling around them right now?
Yeah, eye for an eye. Right?
Eye for an eye. Vengeance. Fueled for the, you know, hey, you killed Miss Sandy, I'm going to kill all of you. It's, you know, you send one of yours to the hospital, but send one of yours to the morgue. It's a, It actually works. They work as sort of metaphors for everything that's going on.
Yeah.
And
so
it's like,
it kind of works as this,
because it's brother versus
microcosm, right?
Yeah. It's brother versus brother. It's unresolved issues. There's bigger things at stake. Mm-hmm. Like we saw with the White Walkers. And all that it did was put a pause on the nonsense. Instead of it being like, hey, you know what? We've got a bigger thing. We should put all of our differences aside to just survive as human beings. But no, we're going to get caught up with so many other issues. And, you know, like, again, if Martin's intent is to use the White Walkers as sort of a climate change allegory, then yeah, it's like, we'll do a little bit to fight it. But really, we're going to fight about so many other things while the world burns around us. We're going to get caught up in our own petty differences, things that we, you know, grudges that we've got, while the world literally falls apart around us.
That's right. And in that way, it kind of works as a microcosm for this episode and also the entire series.
Yeah.
So I think I appreciated that more second time through.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
I liked Arya when she kind of wakes up and she like looks like, you know, death warmed over or whatever. You know, a lot of dust and blood on her face. And she kind of, to my mind, kind of looked like a ghost.
Yeah.
And like way back in the day, she, and this may be a book thing, but she used to call herself the ghost of Harrenhal. So she actually referred to herself as a ghost a couple times. So I liked that. I thought that was a nice little callback. I thought there were several callbacks in this episode.
You know, so here's the thing. And this is where I said I was disappointed because I didn't feel like it was a great episode. Because I felt that despite its running time, it was abrupt. It spent, like we've talked about, like if you give me, you know, less burning in the streets, because I kind of get it, and maybe little to no Euron Jaime, you could have spent some time working on some of those other things like that we've just sort of fleshed out that may or may not have even been intended, but they could have really been benefited by handling them in a more Game of Thrones-y nuanced way.
Yeah, right.
I think you actually have an episode that's pretty damn good. And I do not think this
again, this is an editing issue. Now, there are a couple major plot points that we had issues with, right? So that,
yeah,
that's a problem. But again, it's like, are you sure you don't want to re-edit this? Because there might be a way to do it.
Yeah.
You could re-edit it.
If you're going to take out a cup, You could take out a Euron. So with that, so I guess again, going with just the tomato meter, which I understand is not the end all be all, but it's a pretty good glimpse, right? It's a 48% episode, and I don't think it is. I mean, it's not an F. It's probably a C+, and even that, I'll give it a C+ with some A and B+ moments, and that's not terrible.
What if you had like a Danny Targaryen tattoo?
Okay, so now this is great because this actually came up in a conversation last night.
Like, what if you had a Dracarys tattoo?
So we before we went to watch this, we went out for a little, got a bite, had a couple beers, burgers, get ourselves in a good place, you know, before we ventured into what we figured was, you know, a slip and slide into a pool of diarrhea and
diarrhea and mayhem.
And we talked about a mutual friend of ours who got pretty tatted up, not necessarily with Danny, but like tatted up with the show, with show stuff as the show was going on. Really? And then I'm like, now you have an advantage of going, hey man, I'm going to read the books and say, that's what I'm about. That's fine. But like, if you walked away from this show going, oh crap, this show just sort of left me wanting. Well, that's not what your body says. So you think about that and you go, that's a tough one. And I'm sure Danny, and I'm sure, you know, people have changed their names of their dogs from like Drogon to, I don't know, to who knows what.
Or named their children Daenerys.
Yeah. No doubt.
I mean, that's going on out there, man.
So I definitely could see that being like, well, but also it's like, yeah, maybe.
Or maybe. use the same wedding vows and right. for the seven gods in your wedding.
Right. I mean, that's not Weiss and Benioff's fault. You know what I mean? I'm not going to hold them accountable for that. So if you're upset because you've made some bizarre choices based on this show, I think you deserve to have your city burned down.
All right. I'm just going to go through the people that died. All right.
So, do you have the census from King's Landing?
We do have a dismemberment count. I counted one beheading. Oddly, a lot of burning, not a lot of dismemberment. So Qyburn gets it, right?
Yeah.
Both Cersei and Jaime, Euron, both the Mountain and the Hound.
Right.
I guess this woman who we've been following through the city, that we don't know her name, but she's a commoner and she's got a daughter.
Yeah.
Both her and her daughter get burned. Varys, of course, famously.
Yeah.
Varys gets it. So quite a few people get snuffed out this episode.
Mm-hmm.
The leader of the gold company gets it. I mean, for a penultimate episode, right?
Yeah, that's pretty big. I mean, that's big. Cersei's gone, right?
I almost feel like, is that too many? Like, for any one of those deaths to matter individually? Like,
I see what you're saying. For them to matter.
Varys got the death and the moment, right?
Yeah, so Varys, I think, was done very well. I think, you know, the Hound and the Mountain, they did very well. Again,
even so, they could have shot it differently to make that
matter more.
They could have like made it more prominent, I suppose.
I think Qyburn's death was fine. In fact, I think that's perfect because Qyburn is one of these guys where it's like he doesn't deserve a huge send off, but the how he died and how abrupt he died. Because of
how quickly the Mountain can dispose of him.
I thought that was great.
If he wants to.
I think there was a lot baked into that. And so I think that was actually a pretty good moment. I think the Jaime Cersei one it felt a little anticlimactic. Euron could have been killed an episode ago. Overall, I think it was actually okay. I think the Jaime Cersei one should have had more gravity, but it was also hard because I feel like I was still wrestling with the idea of like, do I care, or what do I care? Like, if he goes back, I need to know why this matters. And if it's just about them two dying in each other's arms, I'm like, I don't like Cersei, so I don't want her to be like, I don't want her to have closure necessarily. And then with Jamie, it's like, well, this is the closure I didn't want you to have, but I don't have a problem with it. I think
lot of people wanted Arya to get Cersei. To get Cersei, and then a lot of people wanted Jamie to kill Cersei. And I'll tell you.
Well, okay. You could, but I think that there is watching them crumble under the weight of their own legacy is pretty good. It's pretty good.
That's pretty good. However, okay, so let me tell you the big fan conversation leading up to this, and there was a lot of question about who kills Cersei for years. Who's going to kill Cersei? There was one major theory that it's got to be Arya because Cersei's on the list, right?
Right.
Arya's got a list. Cersei's on it. Joffrey's gone. She can't get Joffrey, right? All right. So anyway, that was one theory. The other theory was it's got to be Jaime. Mm. Because there was this little prophecy that Cersei goes to this woods witch and gets a prophecy that all of her children are going to die or whatever. And the part that is included in the book but not the show is that she will be killed by this Valonqar. Valonqar simply means younger brother. Mm. And so you get a lot of talk about the Valonqar theory, whatever. So here we have this idea of one of her younger brothers, that either meaning, you know, Jaime or Tyrion, is actually going to kill her in the end. And it would have been somewhat poetic, I think, if Jaime kills her. And I think that in a sense you might be able to say, well, he kind of did because he let her down to the, you know, to her ultimate demise. A lot of fans were not happy with it. It was like, wait, I didn't get either of those two, and the roof falls in on her?
Yeah.
Like, that's not what I mean,
if you want to follow the technicalities, that you could say that both Jaime and Tyrion. Tyrion's the one who tells him where to take her.
That's true.
He takes her down there.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, granted, neither of it was intentional, but that's kind of the beauty of prophecy in some cases.
You read into it. You read into it.
And so, so that happens, right? And then ultimately Tyrion was on the side that was the one that, I mean, he does kind of put her in a position to do this, even though he didn't want it. I mean, there's a lot to be, to me, that, and again, I get it. Fans have the things that matter to them. Hey, I'm the guy that's still like, Night King on the throne is pretty cool, though.
Now, let me tell you one more thing. And no one else cares about this but me. I can probably guarantee you that, like, I'm in a percentage of 1% of people who are going to care about this.
Lay it on me.
All right. The title of this episode is called The Bells. Mm-hmm. And there's, like, about 15 shots of that bell tower. Like, they just show that bell tower over and over and over again, right? So they're really, really focused on the bells as some kind of metaphor for the episode. Tyrion's talking about the bells. The people are shouting, ring the bells, right? Mm-hmm. So they're focusing. It's like there's a spotlight on that bell tower. I don't know if you noticed this, but there was a little symbol in the bell tower. It's called a quadrifoil. It looks like a little four-leaf clover, but it's like shaped like a cross. Okay. You probably didn't notice it, but I noticed it. And every single time they would show the bell tower, they would have a little quadrifoil. That comes out of the medieval world. And I'm thinking, well, if you're going to spotlight it, give me like a seven-pointed star or something. Give me something that like would work for
this time.
Faith of the Seven or whatever. Yeah. There's nothing about a quadrifoil that works with this world that you've given me prior to this.
Right. Okay.
And so that just a little thing that took me out. It's like just because I happen to know that, like, pay attention to the details, people, because there's no way a quadrifoil is going to be on that tower. It's going to be the seven-pointed star or something. And I'd probably overlook it. No problem. But the 15th time you show me the tower, that's what I'm thinking about. So anyway, it is the definition of a nitpick. But it's something that I noticed.
Okay.
All right. Finally.
Yeah.
a major part of this episode was following this woman through the crowds. Mm-hmm. A woman you don't know. You don't know her name. She's just kind of like the avatar for the common person.
Right.
She is the face of these innocent people that Danny's about to murder.
She's right? Joe the plumber.
She's Joe the plumber. All right. And she's got a daughter. I think that was fairly effective. You know, we're kind of following her throughout the crowds or whatever. Would that have worked better if it was Hot Pie?
Oh, interesting.
Just Hot Pie, like, running from, like, station to station, you know, handing out bread, talking to people about recipes. And he gets killed in the end, and Arya sees that he dies, and, you know, charred bread loaf in his hand.
Somebody that we knew, in other words.
He's a commoner that we know.
Yeah, yeah. That's so interesting.
I guess I'm supposed to care about this woman who I don't know.
Right, you know. Yeah. I guess because it's like, and the fact that you don't know her, but you're supposed to have some sort of a connection. I mean, mm-hmm. I found that to be fine.
you don't want Hot Pie?
I mean, I'm always down for more Hot Pie, but here's the thing. I want to live in a world where Hot Pie is still alive.
He's trying to, like, bake a loaf of bread, and there's wildfire under the burner.
If you can come, if everyone at the end of the day goes, but I can promise, if Weiss and Benioff said, but I promise you Hot Pie is still alive, I bet you a lot of people go, oh, okay, no, then it's fine.
He comes out with a loaf of flaming bread. He scares off the hound because the hound is afraid of fire.
Or he runs up to Danny and says, I made a dragon-shaped bread, and then she softens. Nobody's ever made me bread before.
Yeah, that would have been great.
And then he just sticks a knife right in her.
Just a really missed opportunity.
And then the next episode is just Hot Pie on the Iron Throne.
But it's a baked Iron Throne.
I think it's fine. I mean, I'm trying not to be difficult. I have issues with editing, pacing, and a couple of things. But like overall, I think Heather didn't like it.
Why didn't Heather like it?
she really felt. I think for her, it was just so tonally different, and so like. Yeah. I think the abruptness mattered. I don't even necessarily think that she had a problem with Danny wiping everything out. I think it was just there were other elements. Like she was getting taken out at different spots. And she was like, no, I think this is a frustrating and unfortunate episode. And I just didn't see it that way. For the big reasons, for the smaller reasons or for some of the issues, like I could sit there and say, yeah, this is not one of their best efforts from a production standpoint, but I said from a narrative standpoint, I don't really have a lot of problems with it. In fact, I think that they did a lot of really good things.
I mean, I think I'm with her in the sense that this episode was quite the spectacle, right?
Right.
And I almost felt like, okay, so you're done with your Game of Thrones narrative about 20 minutes in. Mm-hmm. Now let the spectacle begin. And I kind of feel like, is there a way to give me the spectacle, but yeah, do it in a way that's faithful to Game of Thrones?
Sure. Well, and here was what I said when it was over. And I think, and she agreed at the time. And I don't know if she's still feels the same way. But I said, yeah, this does not feel like an episode that belongs to the show we've been watching for 7.5 seasons.
Yeah, yeah.
However, would you have enjoyed a series that was like this? And she's like, yeah. So going back to what you said, I think last time was about this is the greatest fantasy portrayal you've seen.
Yeah, on any screen.
On any screen.
Yeah.
So, and that still holds true. Everything you saw, I think, still holds true, right? this, if there was an entire episode or if there was an entire series that was kind of like this, I think we'd still like it. We would not say it is the greatest. And you would be, you'd probably be, so I guess, and I understand these episodes don't exist in a vacuum, but I also think it's real easy to go, this isn't the Game of Thrones that I fell in love with. Therefore it's shit. Cause I don't buy that. I'm not trying to defend it overly. I mean, I think people should be disappointed with this episode. Let me be real clear about that. I don't think that I'm not going to sit there and go, well, if you're disappointed, blah, blah, but I will take exception with, if you think that Danny wasn't headed down this path, I don't think you were paying attention.
I think my takeaway from this episode is that it had major problems. There was a lot that I liked in it, but it doesn't make me like the series leading up to this less.
Sure. Right. And I think that that's important. And I don't know that people that I've talked to have been able to reconcile that.
Yeah, I think
they feel that this was such a major letdown that that all of it is not worth revisiting. So this is how many times have you seen this episode now that you've rewatched it?
It's probably my third time, second or third.
Have you felt the same about it each time? Have you appreciated it more? Have you liked it less?
When I first watched it, I thought, okay. You know, I've been on kind of the Danny is on a sort of the tyrant track. I was on that long before a lot of other people. So I was kind of waiting for her to go full Mad King. So that there was a little gratification there. And then I listened to social media and podcasts and whatnot and rewatched it. And I thought, actually, they're kind of right. There's a few things about this that are really, really troubling. And so let's say this is my third time through. There were things that I liked about this episode that I didn't like before, like the Mountain and the Hound fight. I appreciated that in a new way this time around. I caught the parallels with, like, you know, the bells third time around, which I really appreciated. So I think my opinion of it has gotten better. I think it's, you know, solid B range. I'm not willing to give it anything less than that.
Okay. Yeah. I walked out of this thing going C+ and maybe that's more tonally than anything else, because overall, I still think that an episode like this had a handful of A- moments, which, you know, you got to give it credit, you know, for a time when the criticism is they're mailing it in. I'm like, yeah, but how do you know, you got to be pretty good if you can mail it in and still have some really good moments in it and some stuff that's worth talking about.
Mm-hmm. Although you haven't watched the next episode yet.
Well, see, that's this is my hope. This is where I am, Tyrion, holding out hope. I'm like, give me a whopper. bring on the diarrhea.
Let's just get you on the record here. What's going to happen? What's going to happen? Like, what? How do you conclude this, knowing what you know?
Right. That's a tough one because, I mean, we don't know what's going on right now with the North. I mean, the show does feel like they're like every time Jon shows up, they're like, oh, that's right, Jon. It feels like a Jon Danny showdown is inevitable.
Yeah.
I walked away from this thing going, Arya's got to at least try to kill Danny, right? I mean,
there's the possibility is that's the way that this episode ends, is Arya riding out on a white horse.
Right, and which suggests a certain heroism.
Yeah, it's like she's the good cowboy or something, right? So maybe like there she's, you know,
who's left on the list, right? And the thing is, Danny was never on the list that we know of, but she should be now.
You would imagine she's on now.
She should be now, right? And so whether or not she'll prevail, because that's the thing is,
although her resolution with the Hound, I think means that she's not a vengeance monster anymore.
That's fair. But she still can be someone who protects her family. And so that's kind of like the if John's in danger thing potentially. Or I mean, I also, to be honest, I'm like looking at the way things are going, I'm like, I could see this ending pretty bleak. If the lesson that we're working towards is, you know, power corrupts, mm-hmm. It would be weird if it didn't at the end. You know what I mean? It's like, why would you take us this far and then all of a sudden add a new quick wrinkle? But that's the other thing that the show has been doing is the abruptness. So it could very well be like, oh, Sansa's on the throne. Ta-da!
It is a show with magic.
Yeah, that's right. It's magic. No, so there is so I feel like there's a higher probability of an improbable ta-da ending that is going to leave me like, I mean, I, unless it just ends with, you know, the book closing and Fred Savage is saying, wait, that's it? That's, it's over? And, you know, Peter Falk is like, look, kid, you got to get back into bed. I can't keep going on with this. There's a whole story of Targaryens that to come. You get your rest.
All the rest is just kissing incest.
That's right. Well, I don't mind the incest so much. Oh, we don't mind the incest so much now, okay. So you still think that that my wish will come true?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. This is incredible.
Oh, yeah.
Incredible. I thought maybe it'd be like, well, if he didn't mind this episode, maybe he'll be okay with this. Oh, boy, this is so exciting.
Well, I think I'm on the record for saying you'll think it's fine until a moment, and then you'll just laugh gleefully at how absurd the entire thing is.
Mm-mm-mm. This is, man, I didn't think, I thought I was coming into this.
You thought you're out of the woods, didn't you?
Oh, my God, I did.
Yeah. Okay.
Man, so get it.
Yeah.